A little idle chatter about the people that we know. And though it doesn't matter, is there a different way of saying hello?
You're listening to a podcast of The View, brought to you by the Church of the Larger Fellowship. To subscribe to this podcast, visit www.questformeaning.org or search for Church of the Larger Fellowship in the iTunes Store.
Hello, everybody. This is Meg Riley. We're here for another round with The View. We'll start by having our regulars introduce themselves, and then we will move along to our special guests today.
Hi, I'm Joanna Fontaine Crawford, and I am in Austin, Texas.
Good morning, everyone. I'm Michael Tino. I'm here in Peekskill, New York. It's good to be back.
And I'm actually in Bismarck, North Dakota today. I've been here this week. Different Unitarian Universalist ministers are coming through here to support Karen Van Fossen, who is the solo minister in a small congregation here that has been the only congregation in Bismarck support mainstream congregation supporting the Standing Rock water carriers. So Karen has been, you know, she's allegedly halftime. She's been working really hard, and it's been quite amazing to be here and to notice the respect with which she is held by the indigenous communities. It's been inspiring to see such a small congregation so active. And of course, the camps are shut down. So I was here, they did basically a celebration of life for the camps, and everyone came and told stories about their experience with the camps. It was very beautiful, and I got to witness it. Today, they are receiving the Courageous Love Award. President Peter Morales is going to Skype in at some point and award them with this for their good work. So that's a nice, fun thing to be here for that as well. So I know other people came before me and come after me, and they all want to know how it's going. I'd say the camps are closed, but tomorrow, there's a big solidarity action going on. Washington, D.C., there's a march, and there are solidarity actions all over the country, including a prayer service here in the middle of what will maybe be a blizzard. And anyway, it's been an honor to spend a bit of time here. So just wanted to say that. Also wanted to mention that Black Lives of UU is having their convening beginning today, right, in New Orleans. I'm seeing all these people getting harassed by TSA on Facebook writing about it. There seems to be an unleashing of racism by TSA that surpasses even how they've always been. Good luck for all the travelers. May it go as smoothly as possible. And we'll all be really excited to hear about what comes out of that. I wanted to mention that we, CLF and Black Lives of UU, will be live streaming their presidential debate. And Terry's going to tell me when that is, because I don't actually know, but it's coming up. And clearly, when I say CLF, I do not mean me. I mean good old Lori Stone Sertoski, who is helping them with that. We wanted to talk today about a topic that generates a lot of interest in all the Unitarian Universalist congregations, particularly the ones in transition, and that is the ministerial search season. So we have with us Reverend Keith Cron, who is director of, I hope I get this right, Ministerial Transitions. So he'll be back, and that's what he'll talk about, is Ministerial Transitions. I know that a lot of search committees are interested in this, as well as ministers who are and are not in search. Joanna, I think you did this the most recently of any of us.
Yes, it was three years ago, right at this time, where I talk about being Schrodinger's minister, you know, because you go and you do the pre-candidating, and then you have a whole bunch of time just to wait, and you and the search committee can't be in any communication during that time. And so you're both kind of, you know, in your head, you're kind of living both the reality of I become a minister for a particular church, or, you know, I don't. And for those who are really into this, in the search process right now, they may be doing this with multiple churches. They may have, you know, they're going out and meeting search committees and trying to figure out what is going to be a good fit between both the minister and the church and your family. You know, you have to look at that. And you know, this new town that I'm moving to, how would this work for my spouse, for my children, sometimes for elderly parents, you know, some people move family members with them. So it's a crazy time.
Keith, I saw you move for a minute there. Are you live again? Are you with us?
I am now live again. Everyone froze for a minute and then everyone unfroze.
So how is search this year? Like, is last year, I think ministers were pre-candidating in many, many churches, and there was a run on ministers. What's it like this year?
Well, let me talk about that for a moment, just simply because it's what I've learned in 7 years of being the transitions director is that no two search cycles are ever alike. Every year is completely different. Every year has its own nuance, own set of particulars. This year, we have 47 congregations looking for full-time ministry. And at the moment, we've had 89 ministers in the search process that year. 47 is about average, a little below. 89 is below where we had been for most of the 7 years. So this year, it looks like there are a lot of ministers looking at the same places, a lot of congregations looking at the same ministers. This weekend coming up is the sixth weekend out of the 8 pre-candidating weekends that will happen. Thursday, March 30th is when the offers will officially be made. It's 10 people of color and 35 to 40% who identify as lesbian, gay, or bisexual. And we've also had a handful of people with some sort of disability or accommodation needed. And those numbers are higher than normal, which is kind of interesting. I don't know what it says, if it's just this year or what, but I did notice that. The other thing that's different this year is we have far more congregations above 250 members in search, as opposed to congregations below 250 in search, which means more experienced ministers are actually in the search process because they're looking for the next larger church to go to.
Well, that's interesting. Do you see the larger churches also entertaining brand new ministers? It seems like that's a trend I'm noticing.
You know, people are really looking at folks and they're making two criteria. Do they have actual UU ministerial experience and do they have life experience? Is this someone who can step into our congregation and be someone who we can see as our minister? And I'm seeing a real mix this year of some of the congregations being more than willing to look at someone right out of seminary. Others are sticking closely to have they worked in a congregation or not.
We were talking before when you were frozen, I think, before we got on, about how the internet makes it really hard for this to be as private of a process as it used to be. People can easily tell what visiting ministers are where and stuff like that. Are you talking to people about privacy and boundaries in different ways?
We talk about that all the time. It's interesting because in some ways I feel like I have to talk to the ministers as much as I do the search committees. The search committees pretty much are sort of dealing with their own anxiety with each other, whereas ministers in search often have no one to turn their anxiety to. So we watch ministers spending a lot of time seeing if they can figure out who their competition is, trying to figure out, you know, do I have a real chance here or whatever. You know, that I've actually cautioned people to worry less about and focus more on, is this congregation a good fit for you? But anxiety is anxiety. And we've certainly moved into the high anxiety phase of the search process for both colleagues and for congregations.
I'm sure that would be kind of hard not to want to do that kind of online research. I am now thinking, I would probably be doing that too. And you would be cautioning me against it.
I think everyone wants to know.
Yeah.
And now there's some things that we simply can't control. I mean, at the church where I serve, you know, we not during search season, but at all times, we encourage people to tweet or Facebook out from the service. And so then if you happen to be a neutral pulpit, you can't tell the congregation, not this Sunday. Don't say who's in our pulpit this Sunday. So it has not happened yet, but that's, you know, that was one of those things where I just had to go, wow, I really have no way of controlling this.
We are saying that I think Michael had the idea that March should just be Pulpit Exchange Month, where everybody is somewhere else so that there's no predicting or figuring out who's doing what. That was kind of a fun idea, I think.
Yeah, someone came up with that online. And, you know, I was saying that when I've been a neutral pulpit host, I've always just pretended to my congregation that whoever was coming in was an old friend of mine that had invited to lead worship on my Sunday off, and very few people ever suspected anything.
Well, and reality, pre-candidating is happening in February and March, so we might have to make it 2 months, but that's an interesting idea.
So we have a viewer. Hey, Joelle. And she asks us about an article that was in the UU World about the rising cost of seminary and student loans and the costs with ministerial placement. What do you, are you noticing that student loan debts affecting the search process?
Well, you know, I notice a lot of ministers are concerned now, particularly those that leave seminary, about, am I going to be able to afford to live somewhere if I'm having to make a certain amount of a student loan debt payment? You know, what we have to do some educating about is not only about what is the congregation offering, but how much does it cost to live in a particular place? Because some places, while it looks like they're not paying as much as some other place, actually your money goes further. Several years ago, and everything shall remain nameless, but, you know, I had one person comparing a place in the Midwest with Boston and saying to me, I can make $10,000 more in the Boston area than I can in the Midwest. And it's like, yeah, your money's going to go so much farther in the Midwest where you're looking at, as opposed to Boston. We've had a couple of congregations offer some congregational ability to help the student minister now repay their loan by adding additional funds, which is a great incentive. It's a lovely idea. Everyone should remember, as Richard Nugent says to me all the time, it's still taxable. It's not just a gift. It still counts as a tax. But it's still a nice incentive that really has helped some congregations attract more people.
That's a cool idea. You know, that Teach for America, after you've been 2 years, they pay X amount. That would be a cool, not for the congregations, that would be a cool, like, denominational program to have, wouldn't it?
I just have something to add about that, because I was having a conversation with a regional staff person this morning, and there is something about a congregation being more greatly connected with the wider denomination that actually makes them more attractive in search. The congregations that don't do the pulpit exchanges, that don't have people who go to General Assembly, who don't go to their regional gatherings or cluster gatherings, actually are less attractive in search than those that are better connected.
I don't know if you've noticed this, but nationally, the world has really changed since November. Is this affecting the search process at all in terms of, I guess, where people are looking to go, but also churches with what they're looking for? You know, are churches looking for someone who's going to have more of a prophetic voice? Has that become more of a priority?
You know, I think actually both things are true. I've talked to ministers who have told me, I really want to go someplace that really needs Unitarian Universalism. And a place where they feel like they can make a difference. And I really feel the shift, as you were correctly pointing out, Joanna, in our congregations. They are, the priorities have begun to shift almost immediately. And I've noticed congregations far more interested in social justice, how they can make a difference in their community, what can they do. That has captured people's attention far more than it has in any previous year of search.
That's kind of exciting, you know, moving away from, I mean, we've all seen the church profiles where it's basically, we want you to come here and take care of us and don't even look outside the windows.
Well, and you know, I've seen so much less of that this year. And I've seen so much of a greater focus on, you know, we have to do something. It is now our time. Church attendance is up in most of our congregations as a result. People are really feeling the need to be with like-minded folks and really feeling a need to begin to make a difference. Anything political that you want to say, Donald Trump may be the best thing that ever happened to Unitarian Universalism in this century.
Okay, we're not going to argue about that. But I know what you mean. When I was in DC, whenever horrible things happened, it was the ugly secret that, oh, this will be great for fundraising for all the progressive groups.
Right.
But whether I would call that the best thing. But anyway, we won't go there. So, but I think more missional is what you're saying. Because I will say, I'll never forget when I was in search, the congregation that literally said, we want someone who can come here and party with us. We just like to have good parties. And I thought, I am so not the right person to be with you guys, you know, like, so I hope they got somebody who likes good parties. Actually, they got somebody great. And I hope she's transforming their next search years and years from now when she leaves. But yeah, I was stunned that they just put that in writing. So I wondered about Joanna's other part of it. There are ministers saying, I want to go where we're really needed. Are there also ministers saying, I would be endangered if I went there. I need to go to a blue state. Are you hearing that kind of stuff?
You know, I actually haven't, which I take as a really good thing. I think that, you know, we see people who are very committed to wanting to make the world a better place and figuring out where they can do that, and looking at the congregations in search this year. And while we do have a lot of congregations in more conservative states, most of our congregations are in cities. So the cities themselves are actually generally more liberal than some of the rural places. So I think that sort of, you know, provides a bit of a safety net for folks, and knowing that you may be looking at a particular state that's conservative, but at least you have an urban environment that makes it a little less scary.
You know, you were talking about the congregation that wanted to party with their minister. I remember, and now this is 10 years ago, the last time I was actively in search, looking at congregations that said that the worst mistake their minister could make was talking about political issues from the pulpit. And I remember, you know, not clicking on, clicking no on those pretty quickly. But I hope that's part of the change too, is that we realize that being involved in politics, for whatever, you know, however you define that, being involved in the public sphere is something we're called to do. And if congregations are realizing that more and more, that can't be a bad thing either.
And I actually see our congregations, you know, really beginning to make connections here and beginning to think that, you know, part of our mission is really about keeping some people alive, because some of our more marginal and disenfranchised people in their cities really are in danger of losing their lives. And it's hard not to notice that if you're paying attention to the world.
Keith, people talk all the time about the importance of a good fit. Do you have any light to shed on what makes a good fit?
The first thing that immediately came to mind is self-awareness, both on the part of the congregation and the minister. The congregation who is able to say, you know what, these are our pluses, these are our challenges, this is what we know we need to work on, and have that actually be right. And the minister who goes, this is what I do well, this is what I don't do well, this is what excites me, this is what bores me, and then to find a mutual match there, those are the places where we see the best fits. I get a little worried in this changing world about people who are so limited geographically for one reason or another, and often good, that they look at places that aren't good fits just because the geography matters more to them.
Well, I wonder, Keith, if you might talk a little bit about how you help congregations deal with the possibility that they might not find someone who's a good fit. Because I know that come March 30th, there'll be some congregations that haven't found someone, and there'll be some ministers who haven't found someone. And I know, at least from my experience here, this congregation had a search that did not turn up anyone. And at that point, now we're talking 15, 16 years ago, was a great disappointment to the congregation, and they had to work through what that meant. So I know that you do intentional work around that. I'd love for you to talk about it.
Sure. Every year that I've been in the transitions office, at least six congregations have not found a minister in the first round. They're free to enter a second round, which is an abbreviated search, which starts a week and a half after the March 30th date. This year, I think it's April 10th. And ministers who hadn't put their names in for that congregation before now can. One of the changes last year that we hadn't seen before, and I don't know if it's going to continue, unlike previous years, last year, we had 20 new ministers who hadn't been in the first round of search decide to enter into the second round of search. So when the 16 congregations didn't find someone last year, I was worried, oh, this is going to be a huge carryover. But it turned out only three carried over. So we'll see how many new ministers enter a second round of search, or how many new clicks a congregation gets that it hasn't happened before. I mean, the real danger in the congregation is to call not finding someone a failed search. And it's absolutely not a failed search. A failed search is when you bring someone in to candidate and the congregation votes them down. You are far better off as a congregation and a minister finding a place that feels right and waiting another year than going to some place that does not feel good. We had one congregation last year said, you know, we see one minister in our pre-candidate who we think would be a good fit here. And if we don't find that one person, we will just simply go into next year's search cycle, which they did. And this year they're having great success. For every congregation I know who didn't find someone that first year, they did find someone the second. And what's interesting is so many of the congregations then tell the story, we needed that extra year, but we didn't know it until we actually went through it. You know, in some cases, it's just been bad luck. And in other cases, it may well have been a confluence of, you know, they just need a little more time to complete whatever transition they needed to take.
I assume with all the years that you've been doing this, that you have developed certain instincts about, you know, is this going to be a good fit? You know, should you encourage this? Do you have ways of encouraging or discouraging connections?
Here's where I think one, making sure that people are actually in conversation with regional staff is really useful. It's one of the places where, you know, I think the minister who goes and gets a variety of different stories about the congregation, in addition to the story the congregation tells about itself, you know, is a really good example, because every person, you know, it's sort of like this, the great story of the seven blind people and the elephant describing the different parts of the elephant. Everyone sees the elephant a little bit differently. And so the more pieces of the puzzle that you actually have put together, the more likely you're able to see, this is the kind of work I really want to do. And some of it is about reminding the congregation that ministers actually like to do ministry. It's like you're much better being very transparent and saying, this is not something we've done well, this is somewhere we need help, than it is to only put your best foot forward. The congregations that are more self-disclosing, more balanced, more able to say this is what we do well and the ones we don't, those are generally the congregations that are more attractive and do better in the search process and more desirable by ministers. Because someone goes, oh, they have had a hard time figuring out how to do stewardship. I love doing fundraising sermons. I love talking about fundraising. And so you're more likely to find a better match. It's the congregation who says we've got it that actually is in bigger trouble.
Well, one of the things that having come to the church that I serve now that I don't think I really realized before, you know, going through the search process with them, is that when you do make that match, you're actually starting your ministry during that search time.
Right.
The questions that I would ask this church during my time of candidating were things that then during the following year, I could kind of refer back to. I could say, hey, well, remember when we talked about X? Do you have any tips for ministers in terms of seeing this as a potential beginning of their ministry at a certain church?
Well, you know, it's interesting because I actually think that's what a lot of people do. And people talk about, you know, they knew on their pre-candidating weekend that, oh, this was the congregation or this was the minister. And so that becomes the basis for the beginning. The one thing, the one caveat I'll put there is just making sure the search committee is in good relation and representing the congregation well. Because every so often we come across a search committee that has gotten so disconnected from the congregation that they've forgotten that the congregation has actually changed, which often happens during the transitions process. But for the most part, all of this information that you're getting, beginning with the online materials and then the phone interviews or video interviews and then the pre-candidating weekends, becomes the basis of where you start and where you start to build trust. Where you show them that you've heard them, that you've listened to what they've said, that you're able to reflect back what they said during these visits. You know, the other piece of that that you didn't mention, Joanna, that I think is just critical, is that what you're demonstrating there is, I heard you, and I trust what you said about yourself, and that just really improves the relationship.
I wonder, when Joanna's question about your intuition, Keith, because you are a really intuitive person, isn't there also sort of like a vibrational level? You know, like they say, fireflies vibrate at different lateral places to find each other. And it seems to me, watching, you know, I've been in search only once, and I've watched a lot of other people in congregations in search. Like, some congregations really want somebody who's super personal and sharing, and other congregations, like a reserved minister and a reserved congregation, are a better fit, but maybe not. I mean, I just, like, do you kind of have your ideas, you know, quietly behind the scenes, and do they generally prove out, or do you just try to keep your own hunches out of it altogether?
I'm generally actually pretty good at predicting who a congregation is going to pre-candidate, particularly if it's a larger congregation. And I'm often not surprised by who a congregation picks. On the other hand, there are always surprises. A lot of the new ministers are people who I don't know as well as the people who've been in ministry. So I have no idea how they come across, other than either from an initial phone or video call. But I do think there's a lot of that going on. I think Malcolm Gladwell's blink phenomena of how we make decisions often in the first few seconds of meeting someone, I see that play out in the search process. You know, I spend a lot of time coaching ministers, for example, to present their materials in a way that they will be easily remembered to congregations. You know, I was reviewing one colleague's information, and I said, the most interesting thing you said in your record sheet was on your last page. Get that first, and you know, and give your list of degrees last.
Yeah, I would think technology would really be changing the way that this happens, not just that people's packets are online now and congregations' packets.
Ministers are moving toward having an introductory video of themselves in their search materials, which, you know, I think is a really good way for someone to get that first impression.
And video sermons, I would guess, are much more common than written ones, or in addition.
What I see is a combination. People will provide a couple of video sermons, maybe a couple of audio files, and then some written materials. So, because, you know, producing 6 or 7 videos, particularly if you're a new minister, is rather complicated for search, but having a couple there so that people can experience that is really useful.
So what about your internet footprint? Because, you know, I would assume that search committee members are also Googling candidates. Thanks to the CLF, I had a very big footprint, but evidently it worked. Has that been an issue for candidates?
It hasn't. Most people, you know, we tell ministers, you're going to be Googled. Expect all that. This is a good time for you to Google yourself and see what's there. One of the things that I think it does, in some ways, I think it's actually become a bit of a plus, is that it forces both congregations and ministers to just be more self-revealing. You would rather have people find out stuff from you yourself first than having them find out about something from, like, the internet or some other source.
Mark Gibbons asked how many congregations are looking for a primary parish minister and how many are looking for associate or assistants, and also, what about community ministers? Where do they fit into that?
Yeah, there are 46 congregations or 45 congregations are looking for senior or solo ministers. 2 congregations use a search process to find second ministers, which is what I refer to assistant and associates. A couple of congregations are simply posting that they're looking for a second minister and doing this as much on their own as anything else. And that's a fairly typical percentage of about 10 to 1 or so every year. Community ministers, any community minister listing we post, but we get so few that they're really only ever a handful.
You know, I never think of it. I see these interfaith organizer jobs all the time. We should send those somewhere probably, right?
You send them to me, we'll list them under community ministry opportunities.
Okay, that's good to know.
Keith, are there any things that you would consider to be red flags, either for ministers or for search committees?
The biggest red flag for congregations, I think, Well, there are two. There are two, and they're very different from each other. One is the congregation who only paints a rosy picture of themselves. That comes off as a huge red flag. And any kind of lack of self-awareness. For example, we've seen congregations that have clearly had ministerial misconduct, and they never address it in the record sheet. And they never talk about the impact that has on the congregation and the relationship between congregations and clergy. Congregations are much better saying, we know this happened, and we haven't dealt with it, than not saying anything at all. The other thing, which is hardly a surprise, but it does seem to surprise a lot of congregations, a big red flag is underpaying a minister. I mean, we literally do have had people on search committees go, I didn't know that mattered to ministers. And there are people who think that somehow we're some sort of UU version of the Catholic priest or nun who's basically doing this out of a sense of service, as opposed to, I have to pay off my student loans and find a place to live.
If they think that you've taken a vow of poverty, they're probably assuming you've also taken, you know, vows of chastity and all the other vows as well.
Well, I mean, my father, who I love to bring up, you know, when they were in search, I was like, Dad, you're the kind of person who makes ministers not want to go to the church. He passed a petition around to all the old geezers, which is what he called them, demanding that the minister be in the pulpit 50 weeks a year. He was like, why do ministers hate preaching so much? And it was like, what? They want a week off every month from preaching. So,
Well, Keith, I'm curious, is that, you know, how much education do you have to do with congregations?
It's a combination of things. There's some things congregations don't know. And there's always a piece of that. There's also the piece here that, you know, and this is what I feel like I spend a lot of my time doing, is helping people deal with their anxiety, whatever it is. And so often what you're trying to do is being a part of helping them see what the overall system is like, helping them potentially be less anxious so that they can then make better decisions. But often you will see for both congregation and minister, the anxiety ramped up at such a level that they stop making good decisions, that all they can see is their anxiety. You know, it's really important for search committees early on to get real and specific about, this is what our anxiety is about. And it's more than their anxiety about, oh, we're not going to find a minister, but, you know, what kind of minister are you anxious about not finding or finding? And help that clarify that, because, you know, what we often see in congregations, for example, is it's like, oh, our last minister was really horrible at administration, so therefore we have to find a minister who's a good administrator. And so they do that. But then all of a sudden the preaching suffers because they stopped looking for someone who is a good preacher. Not doing the polarity theory, but being able to hold, this is what we need. And we have to be realistic about what can we get for what we can afford. I mean, you're not going to get a minister with 20 years of experience coming to a congregation of 107 who is going to be able to solve, you know, every wish the congregation has. Chances are for a congregation of 107, you're going to get a minister right out of seminary.
Right. And there's that common thing that goes around in all denominations about the perfect minister, right? You know, the perfect minister is 35 with 50 years experience.
Right, exactly.
What is unique about this year's search? You were saying that every year is different. What would you say is unique this year? Is it the political climate, or what would you?
I think it's two things. One, I think it's the way that the election changed the search process, and search committees sort of began to really pivot immediately toward looking to someone who had this particular eye. The other is the number of congregations that are above 200 in search. I've not seen that many before. And, you know, there are some great opportunities for people to do good ministry in many of these congregations. You know, usually what we see is a disproportionate number of congregations of 200 or less. And this year it's the actual reverse. And that's really kind of exciting, because more ministers who've been serving in some way entered into the search process. And the newer ministers, you know, you don't see as many folks who are newer with you know, only being herded into the smaller congregation.
Are you seeing churches be more willing to, like if they've only had male ministers, to invite women to candidate, or GLBT, or people of color?
You know, I generally see more of a movement in that direction. In part, I think because the ministry is just more diverse than it used to be. You know, I would put the number of straight white males in ministry probably somewhere at about 20% of the ministers in search. You know, if you're looking at good candidates and you limit yourself to that pool, you're really, you know, you're talking about 10 to 15 ministers. And I also notice one of the things that I have done, continued since I started this job, is continue the Beyond Categorical Thinking workshop, is there is more of an openness. There is less mystery about some things. Congregations are less confused about what transgender means than they used to be. It's not to say they don't have a significant learning curve, but it's not the outright fear and rejection that I used to see from a few years ago. Ministers who live with some sort of mental health issue, the congregations now are a little bit more concerned about whether or not they are able to manage it over the fact that they actually have it. Very few congregations pay attention to gender in the same way, except for the congregations that are looking for second ministers, and then almost invariably they want a balance. You know, we have a man, we should have a woman. We have a woman, we should have a man. And that's the immediate place they go, even though that may not be the best place for them. But I've definitely seen greater inroads in all of this. And I also think that's one of the places where the election was positive. I mean, I do think there is a little bit more of a mentality of we're all in this together. And we can see the harm that this is doing to women, to GBLT folks, to people of color. And so it's sort of like, you know, where can we make a difference?
I've heard anecdotally over the years, and I wonder if you've, is that people of color get a lot of pre-candidating gigs, but then aren't the candidate. Do you see, you were saying that a lot of congregations are looking at the same people, and I know we're so small, I don't want to get specific at all, but I wonder if everybody is like wanting one of their pre-candidates to be fill in the blank with some identity group. But, you know, I just wonder how you're seeing that dynamic of really understanding what it means to support ministry. Do you see people engaged in deeper conversations about that?
You know, I think there's progress. I still think we have a long way to go. You know, I watch one congregation look at a minister of color kind of going, you know what, there are things this person does that the other people we've looked at can't. We're not sure if they're a good match for us, but boy, they bring something to the table that we don't see in the others. So they want to pre-candidate that particular person. You know, I think that's a reasonable thing to do. It's just sort of like no minister, as we were talking about a minute ago, is going to bring everything to the table. And what is it you need for your next ministry? And where can this person make a difference? I mean, I look at last year, and I watched one congregation in search decide, you know what, we need a minister who's going to take church outside of the walls of this building and be out in the community. And that's where our future is. And I thought that was very forward thinking of this congregation. And they chose a person of color. I don't see huge steps, but I definitely see steps in more positive directions. I mean, you know, the other thing that I think, you know, really has happened, because we have more ministers of color, more people who are out there doing stuff, it is less of a novelty than it used to be. Gay men and lesbians are kind of boring now because, you know, they've all had that experience.
I don't mind being boring. Joanna, did I interrupt you?
Yeah. What about ageism? We have quite a few ministers who are starting their career in ministry during a time that most people would consider to be retirement. Are you seeing, you know, search committees that say, well, but this person would only be here for this many years or anything like that?
Here's the way that I look at that, Joanna, because I think it's still an issue, but this is the way I think it's an issue. I think if a congregation has two ministers that they feel fairly balanced about in terms of this person would be great, that person would be great, they're more likely to pick the one who they think is going to be there longer. Even though I think in general, ministries are going to be shorter in many of our congregations. Now that may change because the world may change again. At the moment, you know, that 1950s fantasy of New England church where the minister stays for 30 years, I think is one pretty much of the past. And what I encourage ministers, all ministers, to do is to talk about how long they see themselves being with the congregations they're putting their names in for. And then talking to congregations about the fact that we hope 4 years is a minimum, 7 to 10 years is a good ministry. And can you see this person being with you for 7 to 10 years?
And what about the big issue of change? I know a lot of ministers, and I was one that, you know, you scroll down to the bottom and, you know, what's the biggest mistake that a minister could make? And if it says, oh, too much change, too fast, for a lot of ministers, that is definitely a red flag. During, you know, with the way that the world has changed this year, are you seeing churches more open to being changed?
In some ways, in other ways, not so much. You know, we still have congregations that get very upset about changing the order of service. And they want things in a particular way. On the other hand, I think we're living in an age where change is the new constant, where what is true this year may not be true next year or in 2 years from now. And congregations also realizing, you know what, if we're going to continue, we have to bring in people who are not all 70 and 80 year olds like ourselves. That we're going to have to provide things differently for the next generation in order to, you know, keep whatever legacy we have going. So, you know, I see a turn in that direction. And I also think, depending on the maturity of places, you'll see it happen in some places faster than others.
So, Keith, I'm hearing you talk a lot about what makes really good, healthy searches is doing the work to be able to be honest with one another about what our shortcomings are, what our strengths are, where we want to go. And I'm wondering if there's anything to be learned from this for the 900-ish congregations that aren't in search. There are, you know, 46 that are. So there are 900 plus that aren't. And if you could give some advice to ministers and congregations both who are not in search now about what makes a good, healthy, lasting relationship, what would it be?
I mean, first and foremost, is there trust involved? Is there good communication? One of the things I see congregations do, you know, during the search process, they stop and take stock of where they are and what they're doing and take a look at what kind of ministry they want. And then what happens so often in a settled ministry is they stop doing any kind of evaluation. And or if they want to do an evaluation, they only want to evaluate the minister as opposed to the ministry of the church. I think it's really important that congregation take some time and have conversations with each other, which, by the way, are far more useful than surveys, but have conversations with each other about, you know, what is working well, what isn't, and you know, where do they need to adjust? What do they need to look at now that they hadn't looked at before? You know, one of my favorite evaluations is three questions. And the question is, what do you want more of? What do you want less of? And what do you want to stay the same? And that's a great, those are great three questions to spur some conversation about, you know, what needs to happen. I was working with a congregation looking for a developmental minister this year, and they were talking about, this actually was before the election, but I was talking to them about social justice, and they were kind of saying, we don't know exactly what we need to be doing in social justice. And I simply asked the question, okay, what does the city you're in actually need over the next 5 to 10 years? And they pretty much came up with a social justice plan in about 5 to 10 minutes.
Yeah, that seems like the kind of work that all of our congregations should be doing and not just the ones that are in search.
Really, Michael? Really? I can't imagine. You know, there is a bit of a Rip Van Winkle hope for most of our congregations that when they get a settled minister, they're kind of done. And I really think one of the changes that we're going to see in this century in particular is that it's going to be harder and harder to go to a place where you are done. That change is going to be so constant and inevitable that we're going to have to be on our toes in terms of how do we both nurture people and make a difference in the world. And that's certainly what the next generation of folks want from a congregation. They want to be a place where they will be nurtured and supported and where they can make a difference.
You know, it's heartening to me. I just met with a small group of people yesterday here in Bismarck who wanted to talk to me about Committee on Ministry. And I was like, okay. But I think Mid-America or somebody rewrote this. So it's really Committee on Ministries. You know, what is the mission? How's it going? That was just so much more exciting to me than what I thought we were going to talk about, which was how do we evaluate the minister, which is what it comes down to. And I thought that's actually a great way to think about it. Because, you know, Keith, I was happy to hear you say, I said it all starts with trust. And right now this congregation appears to an outsider to have a lot of it. And whatever you do, start with the fun and the trust and keep that central to the mission. And don't get obsessed with this 20-point document that you have and how you're going to implement it. You know, like, let the board be obsessive if somebody's going to. But anyway, I was excited by that whole notion of Committee on Ministries.
Well, you know, I think that's really important to see this as a joint effort. When we talk to congregations about developmental ministry, it's not so much what the developmental minister will do for you. It's what you can do with the help of a developmental minister. And you're talking about the trust is so important because last year, and I'll do this again, for every minister who was settled, as part of the congratulations note that I sent out to them, I sent them a link to Brené Brown's video on the anatomy of trust, because that seems to determine how quickly things need to happen and what a person can do as a minister with a particular congregation. We also showed it to all the interim ministers. I mean, it's just critical.
Thanks for being with us, Keith. We could, you know, we're interested in this stuff. We could go on and on about it, but it's great to get snapshots of the year. I did want to mention that the Black Lives of UU panel discussion with the three UUA presidential candidates will be Saturday from 11 to 12:30 Eastern time. So we'll post links for that on the Facebook page for CLF. Blue will also be our guest next week. So we'll be hearing then about how this big convening shapes up. Keith, is there anything you didn't get to say that you wish you had?
It's great to be back with you all.
It's always fun. So thanks a lot to the panelists and to Terry Bernor behind the chalice, and we'll see you next time.
This has been a podcast of The View, brought to you by the Church of the Larger Fellowship. To find out more about the CLF, visit questformeaning.org.